And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're off to Europe today. Not literally, I'm afraid, but in our imaginations, courtesy of a beautiful new book called Grand European Journeys, which is a so-called moon guide, M-O-O-N, a moon guide. There have been moon guides published since 1973. And in their words, Moon has been guiding travelers to unique, authentic experiences in more than 200 destinations around the world. We believe in the power of travel to connect people and enrich their lives. Our authors are local experts who share our commitment to independent businesses, local culture, and ethical travel. In this particular case, the local expert, if you will, is an American by the name of Lucas Peters, who first came to Europe back in 2001 while studying abroad. And he lived first in London and also has lived in Paris and Prague, now makes his home in Tangier with his wife and children. And he loves Europe, he loves traveling Europe, and loves helping others to travel to Europe and to experience all of its wonders. In fact, he is the owner and manager of Journey Beyond Travel, a boutique travel agency that, in his words, helps passionate globetrotters go beyond the destination. He has written several books before this, including Moon Morocco. This book, again, a moon guide, is called Grand European Journeys, 40 Unforgettable Trips by Road, Rail, Sea, and More, published by Avalon Travel, which is a division of Hachette. First of all, Lucas Peters, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hey, Greg. Thanks for having me on, man.
Explain where you are speaking to me from.
I should say, salam alaikum. You know, I'm in Tangier, Morocco right now. So I'm looking over at Spain, kind of mouth-watering tapas are just almost within reach.
very good. So you sound like you're across the street. But before we talk about your wonderful book, which is called Grand European Journeys, 40 Unforgettable Trips by Road, Rail, Sea, and More, I wonder if you would sketch for our listeners kind of your life history, if you will, but particularly your history since first going to Europe back in 2001.
Oh, man. Yeah, thank you. All right. I'll try to give you the Cliff Note version, right?
Right.
So 2001, I was at University of Washington, and I did a long study abroad over in London, and that kind of kicked off my travels. You know, I always tell people I never fell in love with London, but I loved being outside of the U.S. and exploring. And later that year, I ended up in Paris, and I ended up living in Paris for a while. And that was kind of life-changing, you know, like, you know, being a young man in Paris is Hemingway, you know, quips, you know, like it is a movable feast. You always have it with you, right? So, you know, like that sort of changed my life in 2001. So since then, you know, every time I had a bit of money, had a bit of time, you know, I was hitting the rails, hitting the, you know, airports. I was taking walks, taking hikes, you know, doing what I could. And yeah, over the years, I've been lucky enough to live in Prague as well, and moved back to Paris actually for a while. And in the interim, you know, I've spent a lot of time in Morocco. So Morocco has been a home base for me as well. It is now, and it was from 2009 to 2015 as well. And then, yeah, it's been a crazy journey, man. It's been a crazy last couple decades, that's for sure.
No kidding. Tell us when you created your travel agency, Journey Beyond Travel, and tell us a little more about kind of its specific focus or mission.
Yeah, you know, in 2009, I moved to Morocco. I fell in with two friends of mine, and we launched Journey Beyond Travel. They had already been kind of working on it behind the scenes, and I came on board, and I was just the perfect fit. You know, they needed someone to do some writing, someone a little adventurous to get out there and try some hotels and work, you know, on some new sort of treks and stuff. And honestly, it was just going to be a side hustle kind of weekend gig. And then by 2014, we have a real business, you know, this real travel business. And by 2018, you know, my partners, they wanted to get out of it. So we started talking about me taking over the whole kit and caboodle, as it were. And so we did that in 2019. And then, yeah, we've been expanding. You know, it was Morocco focused, and it still is. It started largely a Morocco focused sort of travel company. But what I've been working on the last couple of years is finding other people like myself who know one country and one area very deeply, and working with them to be able to give the same sort of experience to some other countries. So as an example, I'm working with John DeHart in Japan, who writes the moon guidebooks actually for Japan. He's been a long time Tokyo resident. You know, he's been there over 10 years, and I got to meet up with him just a few months ago. And so we're working on launching like Japan as like an example of like kind of what else we're doing. But yeah, the idea is to get people as culturally immersed in, you know, the 1 or 2 weeks that they have, you know, off as possible.
Hmm. I also want to ask you, as you describe this travel agency in your capsule biography, and I only ask this because I think this will be a nice segue into the book that we're talking about today. You say it's an agency for helping passionate globetrotters go beyond the destination. Explain that turn of phrase.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we can all kind of see the Eiffel Tower or whatever, you know, there's going to be the highlights, you know, but I think as we're going into the 21st century more and more, I think there is this sort of desire, like when we travel, to go beyond just seeing the highlights and finding experiential things to do with locals, you know, as much as possible. And so a lot of ways, what we're trying to do is bridge from largely a North American-based sort of clientele. Like, our travelers are most, like, I'm from Seattle. You know, like, most of our travelers are from, like, you know, places like Seattle, New York, Boston, you know, that sort of stuff. And, you know, we're trying to get them from there and then into that local culture again in, say, 10 days, you know. And you know, everyone wants to see the highlights. So, sure, we're going to hit those. But we're also going to, like, take you behind the scenes at your sort of interest level. So if you're really interested in music, you know, like in Morocco, we can introduce you to Ganawa musician. You can learn how like an instrument's made, and you'd be invited for a private concert in a Zawiya, which is a kind of a sacred space. So just to give you like an example, you know, of like something that we'd put together, not for everybody, but it's very much kind of, you know, traveler by traveler. Like, what are your interests? What does the destination offer? And then how can we bridge those things together?
Hmm. We're speaking with Lucas Peters, and we're going to talk now about a book which he has authored, which is one of the so-called moon guides that have been around since the early 1970s. And this particular moon guide is called Grand European Journeys, 40 Unforgettable Trips by Road, Rail, Sea, and More. There are a lot of things I really, really love about this book, and reading it makes me so hungry to get back to Europe. I've not been there since 2001, or 2000, I should say. So I am just really anxious to experience some of the things that you talk about. One of the most noteworthy characteristics of your guidebook, I think, is that towards the very beginning, we see a page with the heading Types of Journeys. And you have outlined five different kinds of journeys, five different ways to experience Europe. And, of course, they're not completely exclusive one of the other. There is a little bit of overlap here and there. But basically, we're talking about five distinctive experiences. First of all, I would love for you to outline those for our listeners and then explain why you thought this would be a great way to kind of frame your whole book and everything that we find here within these five types of journeys.
Hey, Greg, man, thanks so much. First of all, man, that's really nice of you. And second of all, man, we got to get you back to Europe. I mean, over 20 years, you know, it's been 2 decades. A lot's changed, you know.
Right.
It's a lot easier now. As a say, you know, it's a heck of a lot easier to get around. You know, on your question, so why the five types, you know, so we got together, it was a collaborative effort. You know, I'm working with my editors and stuff, and we're just thinking through, all right, what, you know, some of them are obvious, like we're going to do some classic rail trips, you know, like that's, I think it's just so synonymous with Europe, you know, just the idea of like, hey, what are some great rail trips that people should take if they haven't done it already? And then after that, it got kind of confusing. We're like, okay, what are we going to do with the rest of it? So the other four, those took a little bit more thought, right? So I think some of the other easy-ish one to put together was this idea of a road trip. You know, like coming from the U.S., man, we love road trips. You know, we're a road tripping sort of people. And I think opening that up for Europe makes a lot of sense. You know, not a lot of people come to Europe and think about doing a big kind of road trip through a place like Transylvania. And that's a great place. You know, you can land in Budapest, rent a car, and it's easy driving and it's beautiful. And you'll meet some wonderful people, eat some great food, and see Dracula's castle. So we're trying to do this sort of stuff, you know, like open up the idea of a road trip for Europe. So that was another priority. And then, of course, Europe, another one, you know, people maybe think of the Greek islands, but there's also like the Azores, you know, there's also the canal cruises, like the river barge cruises. And there's also like the Canary Islands and stuff. So we're thinking we needed to have some sort of water element to it. So we have this on the water where it's a lot more boats, ferries, you know, how do you connect some islands together? And then the other ones we have are city hopping, where we thought it'd be really neat to just put together like two or three cities. So, and do some classics, you know, so we have in there something like London and Paris, you know, for a first timer, that's a great sort of couple to do, you know, London and Paris, first time to Italy, you know, Rome, Florence, and Venice, you know, you hit kind of three classics right there, you know, these sort of things would be in our city, in that sort of like city hopping guide. And then the last one was kind of, I love to get outdoors, you know, I mean, I grew up in Seattle, I grew up hiking parts of the Pacific Crest and like doing the Cascades and, you know, the national parks out there and stuff. So I've done the same in Europe, and I was like, hey, how can we kind of put in some of the great walks you can do in the UK, you know, the Tour de Mont Blanc, you know, that takes you through Switzerland and Italy and France around, you know, Mont Blanc. And at the same time also include something like the Camino de Santiago, so, you know, some of the old pilgrimage trails. So we came up with the outdoor adventures, you know, that is kind of more for people that want to do like a bike trip or want a good itinerary for a hike or something like that. Hmm.
I just love this idea. And of course, it reminds us right here, just looking at this framework of these five different kinds of journeys, that one can experience Europe in so many different ways. And although your moon guide explores 40 specific such journeys, there are, of course, many, many more that are possible and worth contemplating. You also have an interesting page that is called Best Journeys for Families, and you happen to be a family man with a wife and kids, and so you are probably maybe more mindful of this than certain travel guides, travel writers who maybe don't have that as part of their own personal DNA and personal reality. I was a little struck when I looked at this page that the first entry on Best Journeys for Families is the French Riviera. I don't think most of us think of the French Riviera as a place to take the kids, but you make a good case for it. Explain why this is not a bad choice for a family to take a trip together.
So, a little background here. My first trip with my son in France, where we were living in Paris, he was just a few months old, and we were down in Nice and stuff. We were down on the French Riviera, and we spent a week there. And, you know, we ended up going back when he was a couple years old, and I realized, and this is probably one of the silly realizations that most parents have, or maybe it's just common knowledge, but, you know, like, family vacations with a beach, if you have little kids, is just so easy. You know, like, you're just going to go to the beach, you're going to play in some sand, you just keep the sunscreen handy, and then you're good, you know? So, like, heading down to the French Riviera, you know, there's actually quite a bit for families. You know, it is pretty family-friendly in terms of what you can find for, you know, lodgings. And then I just think, yeah, in terms of what you're going to do, because it's sort of a relaxed destination anyway. And I find, especially if you have younger kids, those relaxed destinations work a lot better, because you're flexible with your time. You can kind of work around your kids if they have nap schedules, you know, that sort of stuff, a lot easier.
There is a spread early in the book called The European Lifestyle that outlines some things that are really important to remember as, I suppose, you're sort of planning the trip and thinking about the kinds of things that you want to experience. And some of these are maybe things that we wouldn't stop to maybe remember. And one of the things you are most anxious is for us to save time for the markets and for the pubs, where we can really experience Europe in a very personal, unique way. And that public transportation is also a way in which to really immerse yourself in the culture and lifestyle of Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think just slowing it down a little bit, I think as Americans in general, we tend to be go, go, go. You know, we kind of, like most of us, you know, we only have that 1 week, that 2 week vacation, and we want to check a lot of stuff off the list. And I think the people that are most successful and enjoy Europe the most, yes, have a checklist, but also remember to make time for longer meal times. Remember to make time for, you know, just wandering through a market. Remember to make time for kind of that travel serendipity, you know, because that's where a lot of times these unplanned moments that truly make a travel experience, like that's when that happens. You know, it's not like when you plan that, you know, you've planned that half day tour of the Prado in Madrid, you know, that's typically not where that awesome experience is going to have. It's going to happen. It's usually going to come later as you're kind of like wandering the Mercado, you know, and you're tasting something for the first time and you strike up a conversation with the local. You know, that's oftentimes where that those kind of moments happen. So for me, I just want people to stress that, you know, just stress making time, you know, a little bit just for the unexpected in a good way.
You know? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. When you are spelling out some essentials for us to remember, one of the things you spend some time talking about is the whole business of passports and visas and so on. And you made reference to something that I have to confess I was not familiar with. It looks like the Schengen zone, S-C-H-E-N-G-E-N. I think I've, you know, perhaps seen that term here and there, but until reading your book, I never really understood what that was or its ramifications for the typical world traveler. Explain what the Schengen zone is and what a difference it makes for somebody who wants to experience Europe.
Yeah, so yeah, a lot of times we think of Europe as the EU, right? The European Union. And you have to understand that in Europe, there's actually a lot of different agreements between countries, right? So some people are part of, you know, some of the countries have been a part of the Schengen zone, which is visa-free travel. So this means you can go from Portugal to Spain to France to Italy without having to pass border control. Not everywhere is part of this, right? As an example, Great Britain's never been a part of this, right? So every time you enter Great Britain, you still had to go through passport control. So even when Great Britain was part of the EU, right? And then, of course, we had Brexit, which I'm sure you know about.
Mm-hmm.
So like when the Brexit was then pulling out of the EU, and that was mostly an economic and free trade agreement, almost like pulling out of like NAFTA or something like that, right? That would be more of that. But the visa-free travel is a separate thing. So they were never really part of that. So even when you're taking that channel, which is that underground train, the high-speed train that connects Paris with London, you still had to go through visa control. You still have to go through passport control. So the Schengen zone, it's a zone of countries we outline where once you enter one of those countries, you can travel between all of them without showing your passport.
And that makes all the difference in the world. In fact, you say that in many cases, when you do cross a national border from one country to another, you have very little sense that you've crossed anything at all. I mean, there is just this, in a sense, beautiful, easy flow from country to country, at least for the most part.
Yeah, it'd be akin in the U.S. to going from state to state. You know, I mean, it would be very much like that. You know, we're just going to go from state to state. We don't have a passport control. We don't have border control. Like when you're crossing, you know, that the border between like Montana and Idaho, you know, there's no real sense like, oh, I've arrived in Montana all of a sudden or whatever. You know, like, you know, when you're going from, Connecticut down to New York, you know, there's no sense of, you know, you've crossed the big border. Yeah, there'll be a marker there. You know, it'll be, oh, you're entering, you know, this place now. But that's kind of all it is these days.
Hmm. I also appreciated the information you shared about if one wants to undertake one of the journeys that involves travel by car. I mean, in other words, a road trip through Europe. And you give information on what it's like to rent a car in Europe and whether or not you need one of these international driver's permits. You mentioned the fact that manual transmission is still the most common, what you find most commonly in European cars. You also clarified something which I guess I've misunderstood for a long, long time. I assumed that once you get to Europe, it's that opposite side of the road thing. But no, you spell out, if I remember correctly, that that's only in Britain. But that in Europe, people are traveling on the normal side of the road in terms of what's normal here in the United States. So it's not that big an adjustment for us to make.
Not at all. You know, like the so I will say it's the right side of the road and the normal side of the road. I think Great Britain, they have it all backwards. But, you know, like it is like I have a car here in Morocco and there's a ferry that connects to Spain and I can drive onto the ferry and take my car right up to it's a car I own. So I'm able to go back and forth from Spain and Morocco. You can't do that with the rental car. But I sometimes will fly into a place if it makes a bit more sense and rent a car. Like the first road trip I ever did was in Italy. I rented a car in 2003, Milan, and we drove around, me and a few friends of mine. And this is 2003, so this is before we have Google Maps, right? And so we have the old Michelin map out, where, you know, and I thought, hey, Italy is easy enough. You know, all roads lead to Rome. You grow up knowing that, right? All roads lead to Rome. This is not true. I just want everybody to know that all roads do not lead to Rome. You very much still can't get lost there. But it is easy driving, like by and large. I mean, the roads are in really great condition. You know, certain places offer a bit more of a thrill for driving. Like if you're in Germany, you have a nice car, you can go on the Autobahn, which, you know, there's virtually no speed limit in places. So you can go as fast as you want to go. So it's interesting. You know, like I love driving around to get into some of the smaller villages and towns that are inaccessible by, you know, a bus or train.
Right. And of course, you give us some information on this amazing thing called the Eurail Pass, which can make all of the difference in terms of being able to really explore the continent of Europe. We're talking today with Lucas Peters about his new moon guide called Grand European Journeys, 40 Unforgettable Trips by Road, Rail, Sea, and More. It outlines 40 different journeys that one can undertake in Europe by various modes of transportation, and beautifully appointed with wonderful full-color photographs to bring all of this fully to life. I'm curious, Lucas Peters, what kind of process did you undergo in terms of coming up with these 40 unforgettable trips? And right from the start, was that your intent, to come up with 40 such trips? And how hard was it to sort of narrow it down or expand it? Or, I mean, to come up with the 40 that finally are part of this book?
Oh, Greg, you know, as you said earlier, there's a lot of different ways to explore Europe than just these 40, right? And so if I had my druthers, this would probably be about a 1,500-page book. I mean, it really was a process of elimination. Like some of my babies got left out, you know, like I ended up leaving out this really great road trip through Bulgaria that I just absolutely loved. And as we were doing, as this actually was going into research, we had a lot of stuff for like a couple ideas for Ukraine as well. But sadly, you know, those couldn't make the cut just because of geopolitics and, you know, the ongoing kind of war happening there. So, I mean, sadly, we hopefully in a future edition, we'll be able to go back and, you know, re-explore Ukraine. But, yeah, there's some stuff that we had to leave out because of those sort of ideas. And others, just we didn't have the space, or we already had kind of a lot for that area. You know, I think certain countries, I mean, they just are so built out, and there's a lot of different ways to explore them. So you kind of have to give some breath to some other places that maybe don't get as much love. So one of the ones we came back to is Spain, because, you know, Spain is a country I know really pretty well. And, you know, there's parts of Spain we don't cover at all that I think is a shame. But we already have, you know, four different times. I think it's still like there's out of the 40, like 10% of that is Spain, you know, because there's so many different ways you can go through Spain.
It's true, isn't it? I also appreciate the fact that you're trying to give us kind of the high points and yet trying to give us ideas on how to really fully experience Europe beyond the big tourist attractions. And I like the fact that you write about those big tourist attractions with full respect and appreciation. I mean, you don't downgrade or degrade anything that, is kind of things we sort of think of as must-sees, and yet there is this other part of experiencing Europe that clearly is important to you.
Yeah, you know, I think like in about a week and a half, I'm flying out to Rome, and I'll do about 10 days between Rome, Tuscany, and Venice. And it doesn't get more quote unquote touristy than that, you know. Mm-hmm. But I've spent months of my life in Rome. You know, it's a great city. And there is like that central part that just gets crammed during the summer. You know, it is over touristed, you know, in the way like Athens can be as well. Just they're such small city, like historic city centers. So I think part of it has to do with like time of year, kind of when you travel to these places to make it more enjoyable. But there's a reason there. Everybody wants to see them because they are historically important, culturally interesting. You know, there are some just artistic highlights. You know, I remember the first time I ever walked into the Vatican and I saw Michelangelo's La Pietà, you know, this beautiful sculpture of, you know, Mother Mary holding a Jesus after he's taken down from the cross. And I mean, it's just an emotional piece of artwork, you know. I mean, and everybody should be able to experience that. I don't care how many people go to the Vatican every year, you know, you'll be able to have that moment, I think. But at the same time, go hike the Dolomites or something, you know, because like not a lot of people do that. So, you know, the idea is like we'll hit some of these just classic sort of experiences that you want to have. Or even in my case, rehab, like I've, you know, like as an example, I've been to the Vatican, man, I don't know, 5 or 6 times by now, living in Paris, of course, you know, I've been to the Louvre more times than I can count. And there's a reason to go and keep going back, you know, but at the same time, there's a lot of other things to explore. So hopefully the other thing with what we're doing with this book is to show you how you can kind of be a bit modular. So you can do something like London and Paris, and then from Paris, catch the train down and do the Tour de Mont Blanc, you know, or something like that. Or you can, you know, bike from Copenhagen to Berlin, and then from Berlin, catch a train and do like a trip through Poland, you know, so you can kind of combine like a little bit of outdoors with some of the rail journeys or some of the rail journeys with a road trip, you know, so you can kind of, if you have a couple weeks or 3 weeks, or you're lucky enough to be one of those, you know, college kids on a you know, summer off, you know, there's a lot of different ways you can kind of piece these together, you know.
Mm. Let's finish up by giving you a chance to give a highlight from each of these five main portions of the book. So for instance, the very first array of journeys are what you call city hopping. And I appreciate it. I enjoyed reading this. The first time I was in Europe in 1998, I think it was, I was actually on a city hopping thing of sorts. And it was Venice and Prague and Salzburg and Vienna. And I so enjoyed that. It was a really nice way to dip your toe into the continent of Europe and see four distinctive and beautiful cities. You outline, it looks like maybe 10 different options for a city hopping trip through Europe. What would be one of them that you would like to highlight for us?
Ooh, city hopping. I'd say for first timers, right? If you've, and I'll classify this hopefully a little bit different, but I think if you've never been to Europe before, if you're listening to this and thinking, yeah, I really, or you haven't been there in 20 years, Greg, you know, I think a really good one to do is pair London and Paris. You know, you get two world capitals with just more art and culture than you can shake a stick at. You're going to have great food the whole time. And they're very easy to fly in, fly out of, easy to connect to. There's a lot of accommodation options and stuff. So I think for me, like that would be kind of the easy first time thing. Or if you just haven't been in a couple decades, you know, it's an easy flight to book, and it doesn't take a lot of prep work.
Right. The second section is called road trips, and boy, there are some really interesting and varied options here. From Transylvania to Iceland, what would be one that you want to highlight for us?
Oh, yeah, this is hard. There's some beautiful road trips out there. You know, so I was thinking the Romantische Straße in Germany. That's the, you know, classic where you see the castles and the Black Forest and stuff. But yeah, the Iceland, you know, like I'm a bit more of an outdoors guy. So like I honestly probably the Iceland Ring Road, that's one of the ones I just had the greatest time exploring. Because like every time I was getting out of the car, I was out seeing just some incredible nature, you know. So I think if you're a nature lover and you love a good road trip, you know, maybe you took a tour through like Yosemite or Yellowstone or something like that. like Iceland. Oh man, just phenomenal, just great nature. It's one of the shortest flights you can take too. I mean, getting into Reykjavik, you know, that's about as close to North America as you can get. So it's a shorter flight, easy to get cars, easy driving. You don't want to do it during the winter. You know, other than that, you know, you want to be outside of the cold months. But you know, you get a summertime road trip. I mean, that's pretty magic.
The photographs are very enticing. How about your favorite outdoor adventure, or at least one that you want to highlight for us briefly?
Yeah, outdoors, I got to do the Tour de Mont Blanc. I mean, you get it three countries. You get one of the most beautiful mountains in the world. You have these, you know, if you do it in like late spring, like the meadows are just filled with flowers. You know, I mean, you eat well, you drink well. I mean, there's nothing not to love about it. Like for me, I'd say that's probably in my all-time travel experiences. That's definitely like probably my top five.
Right, the section that's devoted to boat trips give us a whole lot of different possibilities, from the south of France to the fjords of Norway to the Greek islands to the Canary Islands. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd never really stopped to think about all of the different ways to experience Europe on the water.
Hey, Greg, man, I tell you, on the water, there is a lot to, you know, from the rivers to the islands. Part of me is like, hey, if you love Hawaii, you love the beaches there, the Greek islands, you know, that's the way to go. You know, I just got done, I was in Maui with my family last February, and we did about a week there. And I tell you, man, like there's even with the tragedy they had there, man, there's still magic in Maui. And I feel similar about the Greek islands. You know, it's just sort of one of those magical little destinations. That said, the Canary Islands is a bit more my speed personally, because there is a bit more hiking. And they have this island of Gomera that is one of the world's only, in fact, I think it is the world's only forest from, I believe, the Cretaceous period. So you really feel like, hey, you are walking in the world as it existed millions of years ago. And that to me is kind of why you travel. You know, it's not just to put your toes in the sand, but it's also to be able to give yourself the opportunity to have that sort of experience where you're just completely removed from, you know, your day to day, you know, and you're plunged somewhere just sort of extraordinary, be that, you know, in nature or in a city or in a culture or something like that. So for me, that one experience of going to Gomera and just being in that old forest, that is something else.
Mm, once in a lifetime experience. And your book finishes out with some very enticing possibilities in terms of rail trips through Europe. And boy, it's hard to know where to start, where to stop. I mean, all of these sound absolutely amazing.
Yeah, thanks for that. I mean, I hope they are. I mean, because they all really are amazing trips. You know, that's the problem with all, you choose one to highlight. You know, it's really, really tough. I'd say, you know, for me, that if you can follow the old Orient Express and do the Paris to Bucharest, in fact, even get all the way, like we have an option to get all the way to Istanbul. I think that's super interesting, going all the way across the continent. You can even start this all the way in London. You know, you could do it this, you know, there's an extension you can do all the way from London to Istanbul. And I think, you know, between seeing some major capitals like Vienna, like, you know, great, you got to Vienna, you know, Vienna's amazing, right? So being able to hit Vienna, you know, Budapest, Bucharest, Istanbul, Paris, like all in one rail journey, I think is something amazing, especially if you've never been to Europe before. I think that's hitting a lot of the big stops there. I'd highlight that one before you start looking at some other ones, you know, like the Douro line in Portugal or something like that.
Hmm. How much are we talking about in terms of money? I think a lot of times when people think about taking a trip to Europe, they just see gigantic dollar signs. One of the things I bring back from your book is that people should not rule this out altogether. I mean, not every trip to Europe is like every other trip to Europe, and it is possible to do this in a way that is, let's say, financially sensible, especially if that's what you need to be thinking about. What sorts of words of encouragement would you have for us on that front?
Well, you know, like I bet you have friends that, you know, go to Hawaii every year, or they go to Vegas every year, or they go to Florida every year, or they go to Mexico every year. You know, that's their vacation. You can make Europe the same sort of price as that. So whatever you're used to spending on a, you know, week or two sort of vacation, you can do the same in Europe. You know, there's always ways to do that and still have a great time, still be very comfortable, enjoy some great food, see some amazing stuff. So I think it does get a little out of proportion, like how expensive people think, you know, Europe needs to be. I lived in Paris for 5 years, and I found, you know, Paris, which is not an inexpensive city, I found living there cheaper than Boston, cheaper than New York, cheaper than San Francisco, cheaper than Seattle, you know, living there day to day, you know, so you live like a local, you can bring the price down quite a bit. The airfare, the accommodations, those are your, you know, big ticket items. After that, everything's fairly inexpensive.
Hmm. Well, this book is so enticing on so many different levels. I appreciate the beauty of the photographs and the clarity of your writing and the way in which you describe all of this with such excitement and enthusiasm and every facet of what one experiences when you travel to Europe. So I think you've done an amazing job here. The book is Grand European Journeys, 40 Unforgettable Trips by Road, Rail, Sea, and More. It's one of the so-called moon guides, and the author, Lucas Peters. Lucas Peters, thank you for taking us on this journey today, if only in our minds. Thank you for putting together this really beautiful book, and thank you for being my morning show guest. It was really fun to talk with you.
Hey, Greg, thank you so much. Next time, I want to talk over a glass of wine in Paris, man.
Sounds good. Let's hope.
Let's do it.
After our interview was finished, Lucas Peters remembered an important point that he had intended to make for the sake of anybody who might opt for a road trip through Europe. And that is that electric vehicles are very plentiful in Europe. They are relatively inexpensive to rent or lease. There are charging stations everywhere, so they are easy to utilize. And of course, by utilizing electric vehicles, you are being kinder to the environment. Lucas Peters' book, again, is called Grand European Journeys, 40 Unforgettable Trips by Road, Rail, Sea, and More. In part two of today's program, you're going to be hearing from yet another experienced world traveler, Rick Steves, and an interview from the Morning Show Archives. You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Once again, I have the great pleasure of speaking with one of the world's leading travel experts, Rick Steves. I'm sure many of you enjoy his program on PBS and have enjoyed some of the wonderful guidebooks that he has written. His newest is Mediterranean Cruise Ports, and it is a book which, first of all, might get you thinking a little bit about just why a cruise might be right for you and some of the exciting things that are possible if one takes a cruise on the Mediterranean, which, of course, is one of the most beautiful and fascinating regions in all the world. And we talk with Rich Steves for the next few minutes about this new book, again, focused on the glories of Mediterranean cruises. Rick Steves, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thanks, Greg, for having me.
Good to be talking to you. You mentioned in the introduction that, interestingly enough, you come to this topic as something of a cruise skeptic. Can you just say a quick word about that?
Well, sure, and I still am a cruise skeptic. I wouldn't consider myself a huge fan of cruising, but I'm a huge fan of travel, and people travel in different ways, and a huge amount of Americans are enjoying cruising more than ever because cruising has sort of drifted into the area of being economic and efficient because of how expensive it is to be on land in Europe. With a cruise, you've got your transportation and your accommodations and your meals covered, and the downside is you are dropping into town with 3,000 other tourists at the same time, and that changes the character of Mykonos or wherever you happen to be visiting. But I've written guidebooks for every country in Europe. There's Rick Steves Spain and France and Italy and Croatia and Greece and so on. And I had all the information necessary to cobble together the chapters for all the ports the cruises go to and then retool those chapters so they work for the needs of cruisers. You don't need hotels because you're not going to stay in a hotel. and you only need places that are good for lunch because you're not there for dinner, and you got limited time, so you don't need too many, you know, side trips. And then design that for the needs of the cruisers and cobble it together in this book. And then I had so much fun using it this last fall, and it really fills the need. It's a huge industry, and there's a lot of people that want to step ashore and be engaged and to be smart and know what to do. And there's a lot of people out there that are there to mislead you and snare you and get you into one of those big cruise bus tours that are three times as expensive as they need to be. And we just needed a consumer advocates kind of collection of guided tours and information for those independent-minded travelers who are on a cruise ship.
You mentioned that cruising is particularly popular among retirees, and it's not just that at least some retirees have the kind of money it takes to take a beautiful cruise, but there are a couple of really tangible kind of nuts and bolts reasons why cruises right. often work really well for retirees.
Well, you know, there's a lot of physical demands of travel, and when you are going, if you're not a good walker or if you're an older traveler, it's kind of nice to move in once and then settle into your stateroom. And then every day you've got 10 hours to enjoy a different city in a different country. And much as I've traveled, I got to say, I was very impressed by how much variety and how much efficient travel we were able to enjoy in you know, 8 or 10 days at sea. And also with older travelers, they usually have excursions that are designed for people who don't walk well, that are, you know, much, much less demanding physically. And you've also got the option of just stepping off the boat and being on your own and immersing yourself in the urban jungle of Naples or Athens or Istanbul.
I have to say, as a skeptic myself, married to a woman who went on a wonderful cruise right after college and absolutely loved it and for a long time tried to convince me, it just seems like it would be claustrophobic. And she insists that a beautiful cruise liner is anything but. I mean, obviously for you, the real reason for going on a cruise is when you get off that ship. And that's really what your book's about. But could you just say a word about the on-ship experience?
Well, you know, I was on this huge ship with, and it was packed. It was sold out, 3,000 tourists plus 1,500 crew. And I would take a little stroll after dinner on the top deck, and I was all alone. I'd go to the front of the boat, and I could do that whole Titanic thing all alone. I could, I could listen to the live music with 10 other people. I just couldn't figure out where all the people were. I never really experienced the congestion that I feared, and I was pretty skeptical about that. Another thing I was kind of skeptical to be, probably sound a little bit elitist, but I was not looking forward to the camaraderie and the social aspect of it, because these are people that are more likely to go to Vegas instead of the Uffizi Gallery, you know, and I just thought they're into different things than me. And I found that there was very enjoyable cross-section of people on the cruise ships, and everybody kind of hangs out in the areas that turn them on, and there's certain people that as soon as that cruise ship docks, they're off the gangplank and out there exploring Europe. And other people, you know, they'll take a slow breakfast, and then they'll decide just to hang out at the pool, and they'll take their little three-hour excursion and never talk to a local person, and then get back onto the safety of the boat see if you can eat five meals a day and still snorkel when you get into port crowd. So the cruises really accommodate all different kinds of travelers, and I'm quite impressed by the whole scene, and I thoroughly enjoyed myself.
In your chapter called Choosing a Cruise, you certainly outline that for us. That is the wide array of options that are out there, ranging from the fairly budgetary sensitive to those that are overwhelmingly luxurious. Can you give our listeners one or two important things to think about in terms of making these choices, beyond the obvious, which is what you can afford?
Well, yeah, but you know what comes along with what you're going to pay is the kind of people you're going to hang out with, the kind of entertainment, how youthful, how classy, how dressy, how casual, how much focus there is on gambling and drinking as opposed to cultural preparation and art appreciation. And it's pretty important. And I know that from my own tour company. We know how we promote our tours shapes the clientele. And every year we take 10,000 people on our tours and 400 different tours. And every year we decide what kind of clientele do we think is going to work best, and we try to show that in our advertising. How you present your cruise or your tour to the public shapes the kind of people that go on that, and that then shapes the kind of experience people have. If you take a European cruise company, it's going to have more Spaniards and French people on it. If you take an American cruise company in Europe, it's going to have more Americans and Canadians on it.
And then, of course, the bulk of your book is really about these wonderful cities around the Mediterranean and some important points in terms of figuring out which ones are going to be especially fun to visit, some of the tangible matters of getting from the cruise ship into the city and back and forth again. I think you're probably quite right in that people, when they plan cruises and choose cruises, don't think enough about those kind of matters.
Yeah, and it is so exciting, potentially, all the different places you can experience. But then you're going to come into Rome, and you're not going to, the boat doesn't go to Rome, obviously. It goes to Civitavecchia, which is a one-hour train ride away from Rome. And then you got to know, how am I going to get into Rome, and how am I going to get back in time to catch my boat? And do I really want to go on my own, or do I want to just kind of take it easy and take the bus tour that's provided for $150? What I know after doing my research is that there are two express trains a day, an hour, leaving the port that go to Rome, and for $10 or something, you get an all-day pass that covers your round-trip transportation and all transportation in Rome on subways and buses. And if you get off at the Vaticano stop, or San Pedro, I think it's called, from Civitavecchia, you can walk directly from there to St. Peter's Basilica. And then you can see your way through the town and go to the Colosseum and the Forum and Capitol Hill. And then from there, you can take two stops on the metro to... what is the name of the stop? I forget the name of the stop, but it's just a suburban station, and then zip right back out to the Civitavecchia cruise port. Now, it can be a little overwhelming, but for a lot of travelers, they like that challenge. And with my Rick Steves Mediterranean Cruise Ports book, I lay it all out with how to use your time smartly. And it just, to me, that's the essence of travel, getting your hands on good information, expecting yourself to travel smart, doing it on your own, meeting people, using the language, having that experience. And then after a day in Rome, you get back on that cruise ship and you feel real good about what you experienced and what you accomplished.
Rightly so. You remind us also, travel is intensified living, maximum thrills permitted, and one of the last great sources of legal adventure. Travel is freedom, it's recess, and we need it. And you learn in this newest book by Rick Steves about how to make good choices about Mediterranean cruises. This is published by Avalon Travel. Rick Steves, a great pleasure again speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks very much, and happy travels.
You too. Bye-bye.